Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 2 of episode 10, where we look at an amazing film, The 12 Angry Men. To see the movie and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and click on episode 10. If you haven't listened to part 1 of this episode, please do so before continuing, as this is a direct continuation of that conversation. And now, back to the discussion.
Right, the next phase of the analysis revolves around the movie and the deconstruction of the evidence, or re-examination of the evidence, and the deconstruction of the prosecution's case, which brings to bear many ideas about how knowledge is constructed.
Before going into the details of how the knowledge is and the evidence is criticized and how it is deconstructed, I wanted to make a general reflection on this idea of what are the sources of knowledge, how do you build knowledge, how do you construct it? And I think it's something very interesting that Henry Fonda brings to the general discussion by critiquing kind of like the sources. And you have a general sense that there is a contrast, or that it is something quite new to other working cultures. So I'm not sure if you picked up on it, but one of the jurors says, "I'm not used to supposing I'm a working man," giving the idea that he is not used to this way of questioning knowledge and questioning evidence. He's used to taking it for granted. Someone else does that job.
I'm just delighted that we're going into epistemology now.
Well, I was just going to say that I think, Miranda brings up a really great point about this, the idea about assumptions that people have and bringing knowledge out into the open. And that's, I think that's, the juror number 8 makes that more accessible to people. I think that builds on what Pedro said earlier about making people own their positions. But you have to get that information out in the open so others can examine it and give feedback or counter it or bring up other pieces of information.
But also have a sense of ownership on the process of deconstructing knowledge. Because I was thinking to myself, what would I do if I were juror 8 and I was in a room and I knew that they were voting guilty and it was wrong? I would tell them the list of reasons why. Like, for instance, the old man is too old. He cannot get to the door in 15 seconds. All these kind of, I would just list them. But what actually goes on in the film is a process, a development, a critique. The development of the critique of knowledge, which is something that the other jurors are new to. At least that is my impression.
But if you can expand on that quickly, is that I think it's not only that he knows at the beginning, but it's constructed like together, because bits and pieces come from information and experience that other people have that he did not access. You see?
I'm not sure if he knows, but I think he has some suspicions.
Yes. That's why he wants to talk about it. And I think Miranda, that was a great point that my tendency and the tendency of many other people would just be to start attacking the other person's argument or listing their reasons. And we said earlier, he creates the space for this deconstruction of knowledge, which I think is a really important point.
So there's a few types of knowledge that are at play here, at least how he's going through. And these mostly center around events in the trial, the first being the murder weapon, the knife, second being how much you can trust oral testimony, fourth being reliability of a witness, and fifth being an actual laboratory type experiment that they performed in this room.
And also if I can add to the reliability of witnesses, also questioning the motivations of witnesses.
Right, so it can be the reliability of any human beings, which is something that they address briefly in the beginning when they're having one of the initial arguments. One of the jurors attacks juror 8 by saying that why are you trying to make it so scientific? This isn't science, or something to that effect. And Henry Fonda, he confirms, says, yes, this is not science. And by saying that,
he says
he is essentially
an exact science.
Yes, thank you. By saying that, he very much leads us into this direction that there is room and necessity for interpretation insofar as these social facts are concerned. So we're transitioning from here is the fact, here is what it means, this naturalistic thing that the rest seem to be existing in, and that's nothing to say against naturalism, into a more philosophically oriented space where you need to think about how these material and social arrangements fit together to produce different things. And that's what's going on there, especially refuting this almost unquestionable evidence as the murder weapon. When he went into, he produced evidence that this is not a unique object, and it can be procured very easily in the vicinity of the crime scene, which is not a very good argument in its own, because like, okay, so you can buy it. The trial isn't about that this is a unique knife, it's about that the kid murdered his father, but it's enough to create an uncertainty within the minds of the remaining jurors give him the benefit of the doubt and kind of go along with him on many of these issues.
Yeah, in many ways, it's like I'm peeling uncertainty by layers, or deconstructing it by layers, like you're peeling an onion. And he doesn't go all at one time. It's basically a series of arguments that he makes, and the murder weapon is the first one. But as you know, Demetrius, it's not the only one. Not even be the most important one, but it's important in that it's part of the series.
Right, and then once that is done, they get onto this more complicated ground where they triangulate different oral testimonies from two different witnesses that have to do with the noise from the passing train, perhaps interfering with the sound of the crime. I think it was upstairs and across the road, something to do with that. So as he does that, it's you could see his face, you could see this very tangible effort, and he's trying to figure out the timings, and then other jurors are trying to interrupt him. He's like, no, just give me a moment, and then they're trying to interrupt him some more, and in the end he produces, through this very visceral brain activity, a result that the testimonies cannot be trusted, because the timings just don't seem right. That this cannot count as knowledge if you take into account the factors of the environment that were at play in that particular moment.
Mm-hmm. I would just add to that in this fact checking, adonico-philosophical, of course, he is using evidence and idea and experience from other people. Because I remember that as a guy that was up the painter that said, oh yes, I did some work around the L train, it's really noisy, and that's, you know, the first thing he has to grasp. Okay, so if it's really noisy, how can you could hear? So he's using already the information, the data he has to produce, you know, a new understanding.
What would have happened if no one knew what he's talking about, though? That was something I was thinking of when he had trouble finding anyone to relate the train noise to. It's like, no, trains are quiet. They're inherently quiet and environmentally conscious way of transportation through the city. So that goes to your point that you need this sort of almost a transactive knowledge system between individuals in position in order for this to work.
Well, he's also building allies, right? As Pedro was saying, he's building allies through this process, which may not be an overt effort on his part, but there are several times when he's asking for participation of other jurors, like when he asks a juror number, he asks somebody, does somebody have a second hand, right? So he gets juror 8 up there, and the other jurors are helping him, you know, with the chairs and those sorts of things.
That's true. Exactly what I was going to say. It's not only cognitive, but also has to do with, you know, the relationship process that he's doing.
And I think he doesn't come across as someone who says it is in this way because I say so, because I know.
He doesn't know the answers, but he does know the process, or at least the principles of the process that have to be in position in order for there. So he is basically an epistemologist in the room. He knows the criteria, and he's trying to qualify what's going on as knowledge or, nonsense, prejudice, assumptions, I don't know, all the stuff that the others are operating on in the beginning.
Well, right, and as an epistemologist or even a social scientist using epistemology, he's trying to make the data transparent or overtly visible to others, and then demonstrating how he interprets the data to give others the opportunity to say, I don't interpret it that way. And he does get some disagreements. You know, juror number three vehemently disagrees with the whole experiment. But some of the other jurors contribute some things and realize that, so their understanding starts to be influenced by this experiment and public examination of the data that he does.
So we talked about dissecting the validity of knowledge that is that has been glued onto an object, which is the murder weapon, and then right. We discussed the various forms of dialectical approach to generating something of value, and they do that one more time. So I don't think there's
I was just going to say that, you know, like, the if you accept that he is the epistemologist in the room or just the person who's trying to think critically, if you will, it's interesting that, going back to what Miranda said at the beginning, what is happening here is that he's sharing that. He's almost like socializing that capacity. So I was thinking of Taylor and the whole idea of some people know better and they should instruct each other and they should observe and say things, whereas it's much more, you know, something that is done by the people, by the group, you know, it's much bottom up in a way.
I think this is interesting that you cited Taylor, because when I thought about, I can't remember which juror that says, I'm not used to supposing, I'm a working man, it's the boss that does the supposing, I immediately thought of Taylor.
Yeah.
So in this sense, what is going on in the jury room is going beyond a Tayloristic view of the working environment, of the working culture, if you want.
Can we say, though, that this qualifies as something like the best way of Taylor?
What do you mean by...
What do you mean?
Well, presumably, unless I misunderstood you, what you're saying is that he is taking this rational approach in principle and teaching the others to construct their arguments in the following way. So this is his equivalent of the one best way, that it delivers a reliable, replicable product in form of argument, as opposed to
I didn't see it from that point of view. I saw it more as one step beyond Taylor, in the sense that if you were to look at a more Tayloristic approach, it would be something that looks at efficiency and effectiveness. So you would have to have the immediate solution, which is maybe walking into the jury room and saying, all 11 of you are wrong, I am right, because of this, this, and this. But what?
Yeah. Not only, it's also...
But here, what I see...
Go on.
Okay. What I see is that Henry Fonda's character doesn't adopt the Tayloristic view of the working man. That is what I saw.
I was just going to add that the difference here, the crucial one, is that it is a collective thinking process. It's not a hierarchical so much thinking process as for Taylor. So he's really enabling people to bring to bear their own ideas. And that's how the whole thing is constructed, you know. And so it puts him away from Taylor and all the other kind of line of thought. And it's much more, as we said before, around Follett or Mayo and Marabout, you know, like this... How can I say, wisdom out of group processes?
I'm a bit. I don't think you're saying that, but I think it's worth emphasizing that I don't want us to inadvertently paint a picture of Taylorism that of a fascist leader imposing wisdom onto the masses. Because
no, but the point is that, for instance, if you think about Taylor and Toyota, the grand difference is that you have formalization, but employees have the voice heard, that they can change their own rules and procedures. In Taylor, it doesn't happen. So that's what I'm trying to say.
Right. But the way Taylor arrives at the optimal, in his opinion, procedures is through distilling how people do work into a more optimal, again, in his opinion, way. So he doesn't just pull it out of nowhere or out of some academic literature. He observed, you remember the time and motion studies, like lots and lots of many hours of people shoveling stuff, and until he arrived at the more optimal, more efficient way of doing that. So it's not exactly that he just would barge into the jury room and say that you're all wrong, I'm right. And then he would, by that logic, he would need to examine each of theirs thinking process and come up with something that is on aggregate the best version of all of that, which is not something he does. He does something completely else by bringing in this rational agenda, rationalist even agenda, into the room.
But again, the difference is that he would not hear the... I mean, the main difference is that he is for observation and distilling the best idea, but he never really gives empowerment to the people conducting the activity, you know, to the employees. So that's the
He doesn't really have to. Here, Fonda has to.
That's exactly the point. You know, he's assumes that he doesn't have to. So,
at this point, I want to just give an example. I've actually been involved in not court martials, which would be the military equivalent of the jury proceedings, but administrative procedures where somebody has been found guilty of a particular offense, and then the Navy has administrative procedures that says if the person has been found guilty, you must evaluate them through a panel or a group of three or four three or four people to determine whether they should stay in the Navy. And if they don't, if you recommend discharge with the nature of their discharge, and it can have this is a pretty significant impact on people's lives. I've been involved in situations where you come in and people say, well, you know, he's already been found guilty, so we're done. So now we just have to figure out about whether we should retain him in the Navy. And I found myself in the position of saying, well, just because they were found guilty in this procedure, that doesn't mean we have to decide the same thing. We're actually allowed to independently examine the evidence. And that's exactly what we did. We didn't completely retry the case, but we were some aspects of evidence we were able to access, like testimony and physical evidence and those kinds of things, and lots of testimony. We could actually bring witnesses in, unlike a jury trial. We could bring witnesses in and question them. And it was very similar to this kind of proceeding where you initially, when people came in, I'm thinking about the construction of knowledge. And people said, well, the person's already guilty, so we're just done with that. And in this particular instance, one of the things I was trying to get the other jurors to, or the not jurors, but evaluators to consider was maybe there's more to it than that. Maybe there's organizational reasons why this result occurred that are not related. You know, because our decision can be completely independent. It took me a little while to convince people that our decision could be independent of the prior proceedings. And in those kinds of circumstances, it wasn't a case where you could just – I didn't know at the beginning that we would find the person – you know, that we would retain the person in the Navy. But I felt like it was an important enough decision. We needed to deconstruct the evidence that was against them and try to come to an independent conclusion. So I've had experience just like this kind of thing, as well as with the opposite example where you get people to come in and they have this kind of flippant attitude towards – whether the person, you know, what the person was convicted of, when it was a pretty, you know, serious offense. And once again, we had the ability to examine the data, and it was pretty, you know, I thought pretty straightforward, and we couldn't examine every tiny detail, but it wasn't somebody who was, you know, he didn't come in and say, well, I have tickets to the ball game, but it was, he minimized the impact of the offense in some ways. And so it was similar to juror number 7, I guess it was. And so these things really go on, and you really do have these kind of influence processes going on. And I wasn't trying to, you know, and I was the senior person in both of these, and I wasn't trying to tell people. I didn't think it would be effective. I'm not sure I'd watched 12 Angry Men previously, but I didn't think it would be effective to just, you know, charge them directly. I thought it would be more effective to get them to say why they felt what they did, so we could examine that. So that's why I like Miranda's comments about the construction of knowledge and this understanding about how you make that more accessible to people.
So basically, were juror 8 in the room?
Pardon me?
You were the juror 8 in the room in your case.
Yes, I was. In many ways, sort of in different circumstances, and I adapted my behavior to the types of situations that were available. But yes, to make the knowledge construction process more open and accessible to people. Yes.
Shall we talk a bit about the walking experiment? At one point, they start shift. Well, Henry Fonda's character, he evolves his epistemological prowess towards empirical stuff. So when at they debate whether one of the witnesses, the old man, could in fact traverse the length of his apartment in a set period of time, I think 15 seconds or so. He asked for a chart of the apartment in question, calculated the distance that needed to have been traveled, and set up an experiment, which is interestingly, the result that they arrived at was 41 seconds, but if you look at film time, it actually takes him 31 seconds to perform that in the film. So there's some measurement discrepancies going on there. But at this point, what's happening there, if we're carrying on with the knowledge, is that in addition to rational deliberation that mainly happened previously, what they now have is empirical data generation. So they can't arrive at the conclusion through thinking about this alone, because they don't have... reliable evidence like CCTV footage or anything like that, or the man, and they presume that they should question his testimony. So set up an experiment, perform an experiment, get the readings. A bit of Taylorism there again, and arrive at a conclusion based on those results.
Or just pure social science?
Well, that's where it all began. That's the thesis of the of the podcast, in a way, that we keep coming back to Taylor over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So this is somewhat of a turn in how the knowledge is generated, because not only it doesn't rely on everyone being able to arrive at the same conclusion by virtue of their cognitive abilities, which some of the previous instances required. He is showing them right then and there how this would work, and there are protests, especially from juror 3, who is at one point even blocking Henry Fonda from walking during the experiment. But overall, everyone is convinced thoroughly, I think, as a result of that. And yeah, you have this very visual, very visceral, almost irrefutable evidence generated right there by demonstration, which is, I think, quite a good idea if you want to teach someone something. And another reason why films are good for that is you see it and you believe it, right? Seeing is believing in many ways.
Well, it's actually a good idea to say, instead of arguing, what data can we collect? I mean, I just like that whole thought process that says, okay, you can't do it through the rational deliberation alone. That requires another source of influence.
I was just going to add that in this case, it's also participating is believing, I would think.
Was there someone else who tried the experiment? I think it was just juror 8.
No, but people were involved in the experiment. There were people laying down when he was doing the whole thing. You know, they were part of the experiment. So,
or maybe the participation in the setup, like just seeing that the time was taken in a certain way, that the measurements were taken in a certain way, just witnessing it. Because it's different than someone tells me I've done the experiment in my house on my own and this was the result. No, it's seeing it, it's being there. So yes, I would agree with the idea of participation.
It's essentially peer review.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last piece of evidence has to do with eyesight, where they draw on experiential memory of juror number four, after he went back on his new not guilty pledge, and they had a discussion about the wearing of glasses and whether he himself, juror number four, wears glasses to bed, as one of the witnesses allegedly did, and of course he said no. So they concluded that the witness's testimony is unreliable, mm-hmm. because it is unlikely that she would have been able to see what transpired, and what she saw allegedly was the act of murder. So she, I think that was the case, that she said that she saw the kid do it.
I think it's also very interesting with regard to the female witness, but also the male witness, that what is questioned is their motivations and the reasons that are underlying their witness.
Yes.
Their speeches in the court. So what you get from the old man, which is confirmed by the eldest juror in the room, is that an elderly man who maybe is towards the end of his life needs a bit more attention, mm-hmm. and needs to feel that he's still contributing to the world. Yes. So he says he saw the boy run out when there wasn't really the time for him to see him run out, mm-hmm. of the building. Yeah. And then you have observations on the female witness, which is a woman of, I can't remember how many years, but someone who dresses as if she wanted to look younger, mm-hmm. To look more beautiful, to put on a show, to give an appearance of a certain kind, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, while some of the jurors say, yes, but they were there to give their, to tell us what they saw, mm-hmm. and this kind of, like, in terms of objectiveness, is broken down because there are more individual personal motivations,
yeah.
Which relate to our human nature at the end of the day.
Raise your hand if you thought about Maslow.
It's a podcast.
You can't see my hand up, but it is.
I thought about how ad hominem all of this is. as you were talking, Miranda, I was thinking that that's not that great either. Basically, you're dismissing jury testimony, which, granted, sounds incorrect and false, just based on their human attributes. Like, okay, so this person must want some attention. Therefore, we cannot trust him.
But I think it's not dismissing it totally. It's just questioning it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Because at the end of the day, it's all reconducted to the main purpose of all of this, which is, do we have a reasonable doubt or not? Because we are talking about sending someone to the, mm-hmm. chair. So if we are not 100% sure, we are not doing this.
Like, I was thinking about what he says and the whole idea of needs and how much, you know, people are relational beings and, you know, how much belonging and esteem is important. So the whole discussion of the two testimonials and how much they seem to be, you know, willing, or I don't know, not necessarily willing, but, you know, presenting themselves in a certain way, and, you know.
Well, so, well, one thing I was going to say was juror eight goes beyond the, so there was this kind of question of not necessarily motives, but, you know, examining, mm-hmm. what their motives were, and juror eight stops short of saying, well, they can't be reliable because of this or that thing. He just said it calls into question, you know, maybe they remembered it wrong, yeah. right? He didn't say the old man, yeah. lied about being able to get to the door, or the woman lied, but he was saying maybe they remembered it incorrectly, which I thought was sort of the modern maybe that's not what he intended, but it was sort of this modern view of memory as being a more fallible thing than it used to be thought. So I think that's the softer way. I think Demetrius has a point about this ad hominem approach, but I think Fonda tries to soften it a bit by saying, well, maybe he just remembered it wrong, or you know, or that he believed that's what he was. That's, you know, that's what happened.
But it is true.
Well, I think we might say that.
Just one thing on the topic of memory, that this also comes out with the boy's alibi.
The movie.
Yes.
Yeah, the movie.
So when
he
someone
couldn't even remember
says,
"What movie you watched?"
Yeah, someone says, "Of course I remember what I did yesterday, what I saw, where I was, and so on." And going back in time, I think it's Jura number. It's one of the early numbers. Four.
Yeah, it's eight. Eight is questioning four. Yeah.
Exactly. And four is kind of like the one with the stock market, the broker, someone like that. Someone very precise, someone very analytical. So it's interesting how the view, the idea of memory comes out in different points of the discussion and on different sides.
Many times, actually. Yeah.
What I was going to say that, you know, again, to this whole thing of the argument against the testimony is that, I mean, they are the whole thing here they're doing is they are trying to say that the facts don't speak to themselves, and they are like questioning them, and the way they have to question is actually to question what is the motivation, as Miranda well said, for that kind of appearance in court and for that kind of arguments they're bringing, for really willing to be, you know, a testimony and to say certain things. So I think they are, it's a interesting way to use the understanding what motivates people and, you know, leads them to act in certain ways, to understand what led them to give a testimony that might be, as Ralph said, not wrong, but just like misconstrued or not well remembered. It seems that Fonda read Maslow.
Apparently.
That is not possible. Not in this film, anyway.
He's channeling, maybe he's just channeling Maslow then.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, both the both the jury and the witnesses, various witnesses, they do exhibit this drive towards communal belonging. I mean, the whole guilty vote in the beginning that was later described by witness 9, where he referred to Fonda being brave to be able to stand up to against all these 11 people, and he must have something to say. So, you know, but the thing there is that someone who is not, who does not seem intimidated to be shunned aside by the established order, which is in this case all these people voting guilty, or in the case with witnesses, you know, just the system that they were talking about. A woman wishing to appear pretty and wearing a dress that is for a younger lady, which is like, what was she wearing, basically?
Little sexism there.
Yeah, just a bit of ageism. But, and the man that he lived, the old man, the witness that he lived all these years, but no one cares any longer to ask him anything. These are all such societal roles that are vividly at play in the situation that the film is presenting, and this extends to the room. So when this need for belonging to the community that that Maslow also talks about is surpassed by Fonda with his almost idealistic, I suppose, in their eyes, striving for truth, or at least discussion, that actually does nudge some of the people there away from this going with the flow situation that they had going on, and towards some kind of self-reflection, where they you can see them slowly embarking at least on some form of what Maslow later put down in his pyramid. That was very interesting in terms of group dynamics.
True. And thinking about group, if I can now, since we are like dropping big names, I was going to drop Mayo in the conversation, because
you better get a napkin then. You can drop Mayo. I'm sorry, we have I'm still in the trajectory when we were coming up with those puns for Twitter, which actually were well received, given the.
Oh, good. I didn't look at the feedback. I will now.
It's okay. Sorry, Pedro. We'll just. So we had two that we did as part of our release of the previous episode, and do you remember yours, the one that you came up with? Because I came up.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go.
Oh, so the idea, my idea was, if Mayo had done his Hawthorne studies in related to plumbing fixtures, associated influence on people's motivation of plumbing fixtures, would he be called Cinco de Mayo?
So we had some response for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Professor Kevin Morrell.
Oh, good.
And I later came up with what do Hawthorne studies and French fries have in common, that they both always come with mayo.
Oh, that's great. I didn't think about that one.
No, talking about your delicious mayo.
Well, Pedro's going to get to observe the big deal we make out of Cinco de Mayo here in the United States, because I think he'll still be here.
I will. Yes, exactly. And actually, it's on a Tuesday. I suppose I heard some areas like it's a official taco day, so it's going to be like ultra mega.
Yeah, we make a big deal out of it. Yeah, even outside of New Mexico.
So now a bit critique
back
of
to you spilling mayo all over yourself.
Exactly. So
yeah, I'm spilling mayo.
Don't
worry,
I got a napkin, so it's all fine. But mayo seems to have this idea that, you know, people, when they work, they follow informal rules that are created by the group that they are in, you know. And it's interesting, we pretty much can see that, because as we were discussing, we don't have established routines or procedures in the whole jury task, but it's actually something that's more, you know, emergent. And I mean, how they negotiate the speech turn and what they go on, it's, you know, it comes from the group. You know, the group creates its own rule. But what's interesting here is that Mayo, if I remember well, have to help me out, it doesn't discuss so much what it happens when someone goes against the group and upsets those things. Because he discusses how when corporations try to, you know, like overlook the rules and try to make people do tasks and react and, you know, try to fill minimum quotas, and it's not what the group thinks fair, so the group is going to react. But it's not well discussed the influence of the person in the group and the whole dynamics that might have, like, create.
You're right. He does not address that. It's more of a conformity thing.
Yeah.
Well, it may not work in all circumstances either, because this is fairly unique in that they have to arrive at a consensus.
Okay.
So they're almost forced into, you know, even acknowledging this alternative way of doing things that juror number 8 presents to them. So okay. I don't know. Is there? There are, of course, situations. Certainly, from my own research, where the circumstances are such that you have to reach a conclusion, mm-hmm. and then when a disagreement emerges. I have not witnessed anything like that.
So what did you witness?
I have not been in a room with extremely sweaty 12 men smoking and jumping at each other time to time. But, okay, but things that I did witness is more... I mean, you know what I witnessed. We're writing a paper on that.
It's, oh, yeah, but the people listening don't know.
Yes, let's advertise. So it was more about making pragmatic choices about what it is that maybe one party can forfeit now and perhaps gain something else later on, and constructing alliances with other majorities against minorities in some points or others. And then there were situations where simply for reasons of legal... responsibility. This was the case with a building project,
mm-hmm.
Or just because someone has more knowledge of the entire project than others, then there would be people shutting discussions off. So in a way that here's the disagreement, but no, we can't do this, because it's going to result in legal implications. So this is no longer up for discussion, and we're mm-hmm. going to proceed in this established way. I have not had this. I mean, this is something like what some of the jurors here are trying to introduce. Kind of the notion of the big picture versus particulars, so that it's worth going after completing something that is mutually beneficial to all. Of course, here there's disagreement on what that is even, versus being right every single time when you think you are right. And in the film, this is this comes up when they vote 9-3 in favor of not guilty, and juror number 10, he says,
"I don't understand you people. I mean, all these picky little points you keep bringing up, they don't mean nothing. You saw this kid just like I did. You're not going to tell me you believe that phony story about losing the knife and that business about being at the movies. Look, you know how these people lie? It's born in them. I mean, what the heck? I don't have to tell you. They don't know what the truth is. And let me tell you, they don't need any real big reason to kill someone either. No, sir. They get drunk. Oh, they're real big drinkers, all of them. You know that. And bang, someone's lying in the gutter. Well, nobody's blaming them for it. That's the way they are, by nature. You know what I mean? Violent. Where are you going? Human life don't mean as much to them as it does to us. Look, they're rushing it up and fighting all the time. And if somebody gets killed, so somebody gets killed, they don't care. Oh, sure, there's some good things about them, too. Look, I'm the first one to say that. I've known a couple who are okay, but that's the exception, you know what I mean? Most of them, it's like they have no feelings. They can do anything.
So, something akin to that, but in a more, of course, responsible level, is what I have witnessed. Not this almost idyllic philosophization of, you know, let's deliberate. We have this ethical conundrum, and let's go through everything multiple times, and slowly, in an almost Socratic way, Henry Fonda makes everyone, you know, see their mistakes and their individual fallibilities that, you know, okay, so I didn't consider this evidence, so I'm now changing to your position. Or, yes, the case with the glasses makes sense, so I'm now again going for not guilty. So he's going one by one, he's picking them off one by one at a time, and he's showing them why they're wrong and why what they're saying is at times ridiculous. And that's not usually the luxury afforded in a real world business environment. That would not not facilitate any future work with anyone if a professional on any given project did that to their colleagues.
I love your example, and of course I got totally lost in your whole philosophical journey, but what it seems to me that it highlights is that in this situation that we have, power is more even because everyone has a vote and they all, you know, we have the veto power, whereas in normal organizations there is no different specializations that dominate each other, there is different jurisdictions, there is no like power asymmetry. So it's interesting because here you can see really a matter of group discussions and deliberation at play, because at the end of the day, everyone has the right to have their voice heard in a way. So it creates like an interesting place to observe. And think of that. I was wondering if anyone would have something to say about, you know, Bernard and her idea of cooperation and so on and so forth.
Before we do, though, just a small point that power is not equal at the beginning and in the end, because even though everyone has one vote, everyone has to agree. Mm. So whoever disagrees, they are exercising asymmetric power over the majority, because they are now the point of contention, that they hold the decision in their hands, if you will. And they can either stay with it and maybe exempt some, extract some kind of benefits in return for their agreement, or they can push their points on everyone else, which is what juror number 8 does.
The situation here is that you cannot go on without everyone being on board, whereas in like typical organizations, that's very much the case. You know, you can just, as we were saying before, you can just stick to your opinion and just lead to a hung jury, you know. So I think that's what's different here.
I mean, maybe if you're in a production line, but if the consent of a knowledgeable professional is required but not obtained, then you can't really go along that well.
Well, I've seen that in circumstances where people will withhold assent, they won't say anything, and then they will not work to support the group decision. And so I was in an organization where that was a constant feature of the way it worked, because people were not comfortable because of the culture of the people that composed the organization. A large fraction of them were not comfortable speaking up about their disagreement. And then I'm not saying they would go so far as to sabotage it, but they wouldn't support the group decision, or they wouldn't be committed to it. And that made the translation of the group activity to or results outside the deliberation room, if you will, very challenging.
Because as we know from Bernard, no decision is very much a decision, right? As well.
Well, I was not in the Bernard episode, so...
I do have just a couple of Bernard comments that I did see some aspects of the sort of a cooperative system going on where you needed cooperation amongst the group to function and develop their own protocols for exchanging information. I think it strays from Bernard a bit because you don't have a leader or a single executive. You don't have a leader or a single executive kind of driving that consensus. But I thought it had the elements of the cooperative system and communication, willingness to serve, and common purpose. And I recognize, as Demetrius was pointing out at the beginning of the podcast, that there's a coercive aspect to this because the door is barred and they can't come and go as they please. But in this particular case, I think it draws on people's willingness as part of a democratic society. It's a willingness to fulfill the duties that they understand are composed of a democratic society. So I think there are some aspects of that about the cooperative systems and organizations. And then also Bernard's concept about the social system being a living thing, or the social factors that come into play. He didn't go into a lot of detail like we saw in the movie, but he does talk about that, this interaction and affects the motives and interests of the people who participate in the cooperation. So you see a lot of that. So I think there's a lot of the things that Bernard talked about, particularly in informal systems, you see at play here.
Yeah, and speaking of the motivational and the social factors that you just mentioned, juror number three, this very colorful character that is very much antagonistic to Fonda, and it's mirrored in the storyline that first Fonda begins as a lone opponent, and that concludes with juror three ending up in the same role and in the end sort of breaking down and conforming with everyone else, at which point the film ends. So there's an interesting aspect of leadership and maybe even authority there, that these two people are very different. So we have discussed at length how scientific and empirical and rational Henry Fonda's character, Juror 8, is. Mm-hmm. Well, Juror 3, he is the opposite of that. He's like the Walter White at the end of Breaking Bad. He's all... he's emotional and temperamental, and he doesn't follow through, and he is not making sense at times. He's just yelling a lot, and then sort of apologizing to people that he's yelled at them, and then yelling again, making personal attacks. He's really the opposite of Henry Fonda's character, essentially. And their leadership styles, if you will, reflect this distinction as well. You know, when Weber was writing about the types of authority, that he had the charismatic, he had the traditional, and he had the rational legal, Henry Fonda is very much the latter. He has respect for the process, and he seems mm-hmm. to not be interested in any personal agendas in this trial. So it's very rational legal. And he's quiet, and he's respectful, and he, at the end, is incredibly effective. I mean, he got he came in to this at a disadvantage against 11-1, and he turned it around completely. So that's quite significant and certainly noteworthy. The juror number three, however, he is very much, I think, an embodiment of the charismatic style. And, you know, charisma normally is used to denote something positive, but it doesn't have to. It can be what he is doing. He is loud, he is imposing, he is he gets in your face, and he tries to lead you through manipulating emotions and stereotypes and partial information and all that sort of thing that is not uncommon in the current political discourse in certain countries, not to name any names. And also
very common in business settings or organizational settings. I've seen people like that do function that way, that as soon as you start questioning them or asking them to, you know, explain some reasoning, or they start to get upset, they get frustrated, they start getting louder. And I've actually had some very strong conversations with people like that where you can tell they're not used to being questioned. And even if you're trying to do it in a respectful way, or at least, you know, what I thought was a respectful way, they just get frustrated. And so I've been in like formal meetings with people where we're briefing one of our superiors or a superior, and the person got so frustrated he threw his pen on the ground because I kept saying, well, help me understand why you're saying that, or what evidence are you presenting, and those kinds of things. And I actually felt sorry for him because he was not used to having somebody question him about what his rationale was, his position, where he was very pretty much the authority on the East Coast for certain matters. So it was a difficult, I was, you know, essentially putting him in a very difficult position that he wasn't used to managing.
Right. It's just that there's so much waiver here. I mean, this whole thing, again,
yeah,
about,
absolutely.
You don't challenge charismatic authority, but you can do so with the rational legal. And you can see the message in this film regarding which one works best in at least that kind of a setting. You don't have a face-painted Mel Gibson yelling at people, but you have a very systematic and methodic Henry Fonda going step by step with each one of the jurors to show them and us, the viewers, what may be the flaws in their reasoning process. And then he converts each one of them and you know, to a level of reasonable doubt, which is sufficient. And that's pretty much the film. It's just him going against, or rather in spite of this yelling, and achieving a civilized, presumably correct outcome to the whole thing.
Nice Weberian summary.
Quite a conclusion.
Yeah.
So I hope you all liked our special episode and found it as entertaining as we did. And if you have any ideas or suggestions, as usually, please send it to us. Movies that you may would like us to cover, or your own impressions of the movie as well. We'd love to listen more from you.
So please go ahead to our website, and we've got opportunity to leave comments there, and we would love to hear from you.
Yes, please do so. If you're enjoying the podcast, also please tell your friends, colleagues, and students about us. If you feel like you might want to get involved in one way or another, we have just launched a new section of the website under the podcast menu, where you can learn more about how your participation can be arranged. We are always very keen to interact and work together with our listeners. Thank you for joining us, and we all hope to see you next time as we tackle high reliability organizing here on Talking About Organizations.